Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. On this show, we speak to Michael Albert. Michael Albert is an American activist, speaker, and writer. He is co-founder of ZNet and co-founder of Z Magazine. He also co-founded South End Press and has written numerous books and articles on participatory economics. Michael speaks about the structures of society that continually enhance the few at the benefits of the many and what we need to do to turn it around. So stay tuned.
We are very privileged to have with us this morning Dr. Michael Albert. Michael Albert is co-editor of ZNet and co-editor and founder of Z Magazine. He also co-founded South End Press and has written numerous books and articles. He developed, along with Robin Hanel, the economic vision called Participatory Economics. Very privileged to have you on our show. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, why is it that in our society we have accepted this notion of the wealthy being the benevolent creator and the people being sort of this void workforce or cogs that just, you know, toil along and participate?
To the extent that people do accept that, and I think we may disagree about how much people accept that, because I actually think there's a much greater degree of hostility and anger, but just without a direction. But to the extent that people do accept that sort of thing, I don't think it should be too surprising. Of course, it flies in the face of certain facts. For instance, they get rich as we get poorer. They have more privileges as we have fewer. They have more power as we have less. Those are facts which should cause us to say, hey, wait a minute, this is unjust. But then there are other facts. Each day we get up and we find ourselves in a world with a limited number of options, and we do the best we can with those options. So we get a job as a wage slave. We get a job working for an owner, getting an income. And if we get up each morning sort of hating the owner, life is even more harsh than if we get up each morning and we look the other way to an extent. We take it in stride. We try to make the best of it. And that process of trying to make the best of bad circumstances includes papering over the reality so that we're not constantly angry. We're not constantly, you know, upset at our circumstances. So that's one part of it. And then when you add to that media and education, which constantly extols the virtues of the powerful and the rich and paints them as you know, if not saintly, then at least, you know, caring human beings, and, you know, denigrates the capacities of us. You couple those two things together, and you get the results that you're describing, which I think, however, were much more prevalent 30, 40 years ago, even 20 years ago, but have been dissipating. I would say that while, when I was a kid, the beliefs that you described, the sort of ingrained belief that society is really okay, the rich are really out to help us, the people who have all the degrees and all the power and all the decision-making, they're out to help us. That kind of perception of reality, when I was a kid, I think was predominant and was the reason things rolled along without resistance. Now I think that that is not entirely gone, but significantly gone, so that large sectors of working people, large sectors of the population, most of the population, doesn't feel that way. I think that most of the population now knows that it's a stacked deck, that it is entirely structured in such a way as to, you know, continually enhance the few and benefit the few, and we do the best we can. And now there's a lot of anger, but there's not a lot of direction. There's not a lot of alternatives. So there's not a lot of organizing, because there's a lot of cynicism, a lot of sort of fatality, a lot of believing, well, it's just the best it could be. And again, I'll make the best of it. Now I'm angry about it, but I'll make the best of it. I won't try to change it, because there's nothing to change it to. That's a different circumstance than 40 years ago.
I still think that there are some myths that remain very prevalent. And one
sure.
that I'd like to dismantle with you is one of the free market and deregulation bliss. And the impact that this has had on our poor majority, poor working majority, I would argue. It seems now that the style of democracy or the flavor of democracy we have is elections plus the marketplace.
The myth of democracy isn't completely a myth. That is to say, you know, the idea that you should have some say, that there should be votes, that you shouldn't have a dictator, that's real. So that part's real. The idea of, say, going to the store and being able to select what you want. In other words, the economy produces a lot of stuff, and I should be able to, you know, decide what I want rather than somebody coming in my house and putting what I'm going to have there. That's real, too. That's perfectly reasonable also. That is what people mean by markets. They don't mean bankers making, you know, gazillions of dollars, exploiting the labor of working people who are paid a wage that's determined by a competitive market. I don't think most people mean that. So people use the words differently. And the media and elites play a kind of a con game. They get us all to ratify markets, meaning ratifying walking up and down the aisles at Stop and Shop and being able to choose among possible things to consume. And on their side, what market means is, you know, lengthen the workday, lower wages, create speed up, create shoddy goods, create no alternative but to consuming them, and so on and so forth. And it's two different things. And then you know, when it comes time for decisions and whatnot, markets and democracy are equated then to America, an empire. And that's another con game. So I think it's more subtle. I'm not denying what you're saying. I'm just saying that I think it's you have to look a little bit further to see what popular beliefs are. If everybody really believed in free markets, then when you took a poll and you said, should the government be concerned about people who are, you know, suffering and poor, everybody would say no. All the free marketeer economists would say no. But the public all says yes. They mean two different things by the word market. There's a real con game, and they use the fact that we say, oh, we're for Stop and Shop, we're for being able to choose what we get, to mean we're for financiers and banks and the rest of it, which we're not.
I was just commenting on the interesting relationship between us as citizens asking for things like social housing, you know, creation of jobs, and better education, funding to education and healthcare. And the response we got was, we don't have the money. We'd like to do it, but we have to tighten our spending. And now in the midst of an economic crisis, which we are told we are all have to pull together to solve, there's going to be less of that available, you know, less money available
right.
for those things that are important to us. So where then do we exercise our voice if we do have the majority and we are dissenting to this market ideology that entrenches privilege and wealth in the
yeah.
hands of a few? Where is the disconnection? Why aren't the two connecting then?
If I take for granted that the institutions and the power are just the way they are. That's the way the cookie crumbles. That's the way they are. If I take that for granted, then when they say we don't have any money, we don't have this, we don't have that, we can't get it through Congress, and on, I sort of say to myself, okay, you know, now what? If all that's ruled out, what do I do? And so I sort of accept these kinds of lies, that there's not enough money, there's not enough resources. I accept it because I take for granted the power distribution. I take for granted that they're allowed to say, well, we don't have enough money because we can't do anything, meaning we won't do anything, which takes away from the rich, which takes away from, you know, the defense of empire or the spread of empire. We won't do that. We won't touch any of that. We won't touch anything, in fact, this is what the rich are effectively saying, we won't touch anything which would change the balance of power between us and the rest of the population, 80% of the people. We won't touch that. We won't go near that. And since we won't go near anything like that, since we won't tax the rich, since we won't reduce the military budget, since we won't you know, change the norms of health and advertising and transportation and everything else in ways that benefit everybody, but hurt us, hurt the rich, reduce our advantage. Since we won't do any of that, we don't have any resources. If they put it that way, the population would say, well, wait a minute, why won't you do any of that? I mean, well, you know, why should the rich and the powerful just get richer and more powerful and we're suffering? Except if you think, if you're a Joe Citizen now, except if you think it's hopeless. It's hopeless to battle like that. There's no recourse. So you sort of have to play the game that the rich and the powerful establish as what is reality. Now, if somebody else comes along, and a different citizen, you, and says, wait a minute, I don't expect the rules of this game. I don't accept that the rich get to decide that all these options are off the table. And what's left is that I have to work harder, more hours, get less income, and lose my health care. And that's because everything else that could be done, which would not hurt me, but which would benefit me, but would hurt the rich and the powerful, that's off the table. Okay, so you find it ludicrous. I find it ludicrous. But a person who feels like, well, you know, you, Michael, and people like you are just, you're not realistic. You're not facing the reality. There's no way to get them to change the rules. Then they think it makes sense. And that's what's going on. It's not that people are dumb. It's that people are taking for granted a different playing field. You and I want a playing field which is on behalf of the 80% of the population, and those at the top want a playing field that's on behalf of the top 20%, me and even more so the top 2%. Okay, so that's the battle. That's the difficulty, to change people's conception of what's possible, that it's possible to change the rules, it's possible to change the structures, and therefore, once that's done, the idea that there's not enough resources is ludicrous. I mean, on the face of it, it's ludicrous. What there is tons of resources, tons of possibilities, but they are all earmarked in the wrong place. They're all going to the wrong, not all, but a great part of it is going to wrong uses. And if we could change that, which is what the rich and the powerful take off the table as an option, if we could change that, we would be better off. We would be vastly better off. That's the task, and that's the organizer's task. And when you pointed to those myths, the myths are all, they all exist to prevent this change in attitude. If the population decides, hold on a minute, the rules stink, the structure stinks, the way the thing is arranged stinks, and that's why it seems like we have to suffer, but we don't. We change all those things, and we do real well. If that attitude takes hold, then things change. And so that's the big struggle.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about what you're proposing as an alternative to this. What is participatory economics, and how does this compare to this idea of supply and demand? Because people would say, well, we would have it. If people wanted it, we would have that.
It's not that people don't want. If you hold a poll tomorrow and you say, okay, the results of this poll will be implemented, this will become reality, and now you ask, you know, do people want a shorter workday? Yes. Do people want higher income, a bigger share of the wealth, if it means less to the rich? Yes, to the rich. Do people want an end to the war? Yeah, by 65%, 70%, yes, and so on and so forth. And so there would be just gigantic changes. So anybody who says, well, people are getting what they want, is again playing a sort of a con game. Suppose we took a prison population. Each day, the population doesn't clamor to get out of the jail. They take for granted that they can't get out, right? It's not on the table. It isn't an option. So they're not constantly asking to be released. But if you took a poll and said, how many of you would like to go home? Well, 100%. The fact that people don't say it all the time simply means that they take it for granted that it's not an option, that they're choosing among, you know, possibilities. All right, now what's participatory economics? If I'm going to say this stuff that I'm saying, then I have to make the case more compellingly. I have to say, well, okay, then we'd have to change to have an economy which really did serve the interests of the population. what kind of an economy, what kind of way of doing production, of doing consumption, of distributing the stuff, what kind of way of doing all that, economic functions, would yield outcomes that are on behalf of the population, of the people who are doing the work, of the people who live in the communities, and not of a relative few, but of everyone? What would we have to change? And so participatory economics is sort of an answer to that question. It's sort of saying, well, here's the way workplaces would look. Here's the way we would deal with allocation. Here's how we would organize the economy. Here's what would determine how much income you get. Here's what would determine what your job looks like. In society, or in an economy that was just and that was equitable and that gave people an appropriate level of power over their lives and so on. So it's an economic vision. Participatory economics is an economic vision as an alternative to capitalism.
When we talk about a participatory economy, it implies to me that we as citizens have a voice and a say in how things and what kinds of things we produce. It sounds to me like something where it is founded on needs, not just production for production's sake. Can you talk a little bit about how a participatory economy would deal with sustainability and justice? Can we have the two?
The idea is you want an economy which takes a look at all the options and all the possibilities and makes judgments. And one, who should make those judgments? Well, the people involved, the people who are affected. And that norm is self-management. The idea is people should have a say over decisions that affect them in proportion to the degree that they're affected by them. So that's one powerful norm for an economy. And if you have that norm, it means that it isn't, you know, the CEO of a company or the owner of a company or the head of a bank or whatever who is making these incredibly far-ranging, far-reaching decisions that impact people's lives without those people having a say. So that's one norm. Another norm is you want justice, meaning you want people to get their fair share of everything. You want people to have claims on the output of the economy and on the jobs, too, that represent fairness, that I should get what's fair for me to get. You should get what's fair for you to get. And we have to think about what that means. To me, it means that we should get back from an economy essentially in proportion to how hard and how long we work, to the onerousness of the conditions under which we work. In other words, if I work under horrible conditions, well, I should get more for that. Now, that warrants a higher rate of pay than working under better conditions. And working longer warrants a higher rate of pay. And working harder warrants a higher rate of pay. Then you need to sort of create institutions, create economic structures that accomplish these things. So a workplace in which workers democratically, and even by self-management, which is a sort of a richer kind of level of decision-making justice, make decisions and do it in concert with the will of the consumers and the other producers for an economy, for allocation. It would take some time to describe the institutions in full, but basically what we're talking about is an economy in which the workers and the consumers, the people, make decisions in a cooperative way, accommodating what's produced to what's desired for consumption, and apportioning those benefits and costs fairly, which means in accord with basically what people are doing, with how long people are working and how hard they're working and so on. That kind of a picture, a truly socialistic picture, you might say, or a truly just picture, is a desirable one. But it puts the lie to, it is totally contrary to an economic system where you have a relatively few people, 2%, owning everything and controlling it, or 20% who have a kind of a monopoly on education and skills and knowledge, again, having high levels of control and benefit, while 80% are left with all the rote and the tedious and the redundant or repetitive tasks, the working people, that's not reasonable. And so what this new kind of economy does is it apportions all the tasks fairly among us. It gives us all jobs which are comparably empowering. It's called balanced job complexes. It gives us a condition at work which is comparable to other people's conditions at work, so that we can exercise our wills comparably to other people. And in these ways, it creates a kind of a classless and a kind of an equitable environment. Then, instead of saying, well, hey, you, average citizen, can't have the income you have, must have even less, can't even have a job, you know, because I want four yachts and a mansion and also an army out there conquering other parts of the world. Instead of a few people being able to say that and having to say that, because the institutions compel those outcomes, rather than that, we have an economy which, as you say, produces for use, produces for human well-being.
You know, we don't often make the connections to the kinds of investment we make and the kinds of jobs that are created. In our current economy, which is not a participatory economy, we hear a lot of our money going into financial speculation and, you know, hedge funds. And very little is being invested in the production of things that are needed, like infrastructure or buildings. So how do we move into a participatory economy? People would say, well, what happens? Like, so many people would have to change overnight. How do we make that transition?
Why doesn't it happen now? I mean, ask, why, for instance, would the government or the people, the you know, the power brokers in society, why would they rather spend a large amount of society's productive capability on weapons, let's just say as one example, on the military, then on, say, schooling or housing or rebuilding infrastructure in the inner city where people live? Why is one better than the other? When I ask that question to people, they'll often say things like, well, the military stuff, it makes more jobs. And, of course, that's what the media tells us. But if you think about it for a minute, you realize, wait a minute, that's utter nonsense. The military stuff is very high tech. Per investment, it makes fewer jobs than building roads and building hospitals and so on. So that can't be the reason. So then the second reason that people will say is, well, it's profitable. Well, interestingly enough, in our society, that isn't even the reason. Because while Lockheed is profitable, so is a construction company. While while the manufacturer of tanks is profitable, so would be the manufacturer of public transportation vehicles. So that's not it either. And now we're stuck trying to figure out, well, then why is there so much pressure pushing in some directions and not in others? And I think the answer is this. Some kinds of investment, some kinds of use of society's productive capacity disrupt power relations. So if you put a lot of resources into good health care and a lot of for everybody, and a lot of resources into fine education for everybody, and I mean everybody now, fine education for everybody, and if you create lots and lots of housing, and so the price of dwellings and places to live that are comfortable declines, and you do that, then what happens? Well, then the 80% of the population who benefits from a lot of that, from consuming it, from consuming education, from consuming health care, from consuming better housing, from consuming better transportation systems, that 80% has a more stable, a more fulfilling, a more enriching, and a more uplifting life. And they become more powerful. And so what happens is that the 80% have its social power improved, increased. They're less vulnerable. They're more informed, and they're more confident, and they are, just generally speaking, better able to express and to pursue their desires. And so what's the net result? And here comes the reason. The net result is working people are able to win more of the income in society. Their wages go up, and profits go down. The reason why military spending is more profitable than education spending isn't because it's more profitable instantly, it's because the impact of the two is different. The impact of education spending improves the well-being of the population, working people, and then they can take a bigger share. The impact of the military spending is quite the opposite. It sort of subordinates the population, it doesn't create more jobs, it keeps unemployment high, and it keeps people weak, and therefore it allows the rich and the powerful to stay on top. Now, that is, of course, disgusting. It's incredible that the answer to the question, why would they rather produce tanks and even missiles that go into the ground and will never be used, why would they rather do that than produce schools? Answer, because the people at the top don't want the public to become more fulfilled, more stable, more educated, because that's dangerous. Okay, that's grotesque, but it also is the reason. And so now the answer to the question is, why would a different society be any different? Well, it would be different if there weren't 2% at the top or 20% near the top defending their position against everybody below. If that wasn't the case, if we all had comparable circumstances and conditions, then all of us are basically asking the question, well, would we rather have another missile sitting in the ground, or would we rather have better transportation or health care or housing for everybody? Answer, the latter. We would all rather have that. Current answer, the former. Why? Because the rich and powerful get almost all say, and the rich and powerful want to stay rich and powerful, and the military spending is better for that than the social spending. So that's the change. The change is from a class-divided economy in which a few people, relatively few, a fifth, and even a 2%, dominate decisions and decide what the options are, to an economy in which we all have roughly comparable circumstances and conditions, and we all together decide. That's a gigantic change.
One of the key issues we face, though, is that, as you point out, this 2% has created a very powerful control over the media. And what we're taught day in and day out is to be fearful of one another rather than to create a society that's based on collaboration or on recognition of what is really of use to us as a community, as a society of individuals. How do you break through that?
I think you're right that they teach it, and they show videos and they show movies which extol that kind of behavior, that kind of, you know, nasty and brutish and competitive behavior instead of some degree of solidarity or a lot of solidarity. I agree. But there's one extra point. It works. That is, in our society, the way it's currently structured, you get ahead if you're nasty and brutish. Your chances of success, your chances of doing better, in fact, in our society, are greater if you are antisocial, if you are willing to ignore the plight of others, if you are willing to advance over the outreached arms of people who aren't advancing, or even over the corpses of people who aren't advancing. Then you'll do better. And there was an old aphorism from a baseball manager many years ago, Leo DeRocha, who used to say, nice guys finish last. And everybody would chuckle at it and say, yeah. But if you think about it, that's horrendous. In other words, it's not just that the media is saying it. It's that it's true that in the way things are currently structured, nice guys do finish last. Nice people finish last. You suffer due to the fact that you're willing to be concerned about and to take care of others rather than just being a greedy schmuck. And I say garbage rises is my version of it. It's a bit more explicit. How do you deal with this? Well, in the long run, you deal with it by creating a society in which it's not true. You want an economy in which it's not the case that the way to get ahead is to be antisocial. In fact, you want an economy, and this is what participatory economics is all about, you want an economy in which for me to get ahead, for me to do well, for me to have a fulfillment and you know, to express my capacities and so on and so forth, I have to be concerned about the well-being of others. That it's built into the system that pursuit of my own well-being is consistent with the well-being of others. So that's what participatory economics does. But in the present, when it's not true, what can you do? Well, I think you have to do something like what you're saying. You have to basically say to people, A, that's what we want in the long run. B, we can't get to that long-run position unless we work together. And C, even now, what society calls success isn't the only measure of success. we really have to consider now, right now, independent of what we want to win in the future, whether it's really the case that we'd rather be antisocial and greedy, basically functioning in a rat race, and even if we win, we're still a rat, or would we rather be people, caring people, perhaps with a little less stuff, but with a little more, you know, humanity.
You're so beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Michael Albert. He is an economist. He's also the author of many books. Tell us, how can people access your books? How can people connect with said magazine?
Well, the easiest thing to do to just get in touch is to go to the website, which is called Z Communications or ZNet. You called it Z Magazine. They're all features of the same broad thing. It's www.zcommunications.org.
Thank you again for being with us.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
Take care. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.